Hello and hi. Welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is pop culture connoisseur George Beam. He's written quite a few books that touch on various facets of our pop culture addiction. Stephen King, Star Wars, J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter, Twilight, and so much more, but we're here today to talk about his newest book, The Military Science of Star Wars. Welcome, George.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Now, I'm a big Star Wars fan, as a lot of our listeners know, and this book is fascinating, and your background, you actually have a military background that gives you a perspective on this that not a lot of people would deep dive into. And this entire book is a deep dive into the battles and the battle tactics and even how the people doing the fighting are soldiering throughout this Star Wars universe that we love so much. How did you focus on this as a topic?
Well, the first thing that struck me every time I go see one of the Star Wars movies is that I have a tendency to just analyze it from two viewpoints. One is, does it work as a story? And I do that because I'm a writer. And second, how can the military aspects of Star Wars, which is a big part of the movie series and book series and all these spin-off products, how can that support the story and how can it be improved? Oftentimes on the internet, what you get, and this is not a criticism, but it's an observation, what you get are people sometimes that will share their viewpoints and perspectives on what they think the military could have done, should have done, would have done, but they've never been in the military. And the problem with that is that it's speculation, but it's not grounded in experience. And when you have the experience of having been in the military culture, you realize it's a different world. It's not a world that most people will ever live in, because fewer than 1% of the American public has ever served in the military. And when you read, you know, a book about a work of fiction about the military, or you watch a movie about the military, if you've been in the military, you know what's going to feel right and what's not going to feel right. You're going to know when the author has spent time in the military or he hasn't. And this is a real problem, especially with movies, because movies are so popular, and this is one way we get a lot of our information, that when you go see a movie like, say, Top Gun, you get the sense that this is what naval aviation is all about. Now, the whole reason the Department of Defense allowed Top Gun was because they basically saw it as a form of free advertisement in order to recruit Navy pilots. And it did that. It did it very well. And that's why DOD supports things like that, as opposed to, say, an anti-war movie made by Stanley Kubrick, you know, like Steel Metal Jacket, or Platoon, or Apocalypse Now. You know, those movies just get no support from the military, because it just doesn't do anything to convince people to sign up and join up. So the sense of reality with the military is a big part of, I think, Star Wars, and it has to be accurate. You know, it's the movies are so unreal that everything else in the movie's got to be as real as possible, and you have to strike that balance. But, you know, getting back to, like, Top Gun, and now I see there's going to be a sequel done. You know, what you see in Top Gun is just, a lot of it is just nonsense. It's not how pilots really act. It's not really what pilots do. You know, I've spent time with a active duty F-16 fighter wing for 2 weeks, and I got to see their life and what it's like being, you know, in and around pilots. And basically what you have are very quiet professionals. They don't go around jumping up on the flight line and bumping chests and stuff like that. They go out there and they do their job and then they come back. And so I think it's really important for people that have not been in the military to understand that there's a big difference sometimes between what you see on the movie screen and what it's really like in the real world. And so that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this particular book on Star Wars.
Okay, given how many other pop culture movies, series, franchises that are out there that have some sort of military aspect, was there something particular about Star Wars itself that made you want to dive into how Star Wars universe was applying military tactics and technology?
Well, the thing that struck me about Star Wars is that, unlike a lot of the other franchises, well, Star Wars certainly has had a long franchise, and so has Star Trek. But with Star Wars, you know, you get a sense, you really get a sense of the future and the weapons and all of that. And we're at the point now where what's happening in the real world is starting to reflect what we've seen in the movies. And so so all the people that are imagining the different kinds of weapons and weapon systems and what have you are probably going to see these things resonate and be created or at least tested in the real world. And I think that's a very interesting aspect of Star Wars. You know, I think that certainly in terms of movies, you know, when I look at movies, it's really not about the hardware either. The military is all about people. And you can have the best hardware in the world, but if you don't have the people that are properly trained, then the hardware is not going to make a difference. And a good example of that is during the Iraq War, you know, the U.S. military had calculated an extremely high casualty count because they thought, well, the Republican Guard, Iraqi Republican Guards are well trained. They've got, you know, three divisions of that, and they've got backup divisions. And when we finally went to war, the war itself was over in a fairly short period of time because it turned out that a lot of the Iraqis that were in the military were draftees and they were reservists and they hadn't had a lot of training. And once the bullets started flying, they realized that, you know, they just really didn't want to fight at all. So it looked like it was a very formidable army, and it certainly was the sixth largest in the world at the time. But as a fighting force, the problem stemmed really at the top with leadership. And Saddam Hussein was not a military leader. And in fact, when the general that, I'm trying to recall his name offhand, but the general that handled the ground war gave a press conference and stood up and made fun of Saddam Hussein and said, you know, he's not a tactician, he's not a military planner, he's not a this, he's not that. But other than that, he's a great warrior, and everybody had a good laugh. And that was Schwarzkopf saying that. And Schwarzkopf himself was a West Point graduate and decorated, and he cut his teeth during the Vietnam War. He had decades of experience, and he was a great choice to be the CENTCOM commander and run the conduct of the Desert Storm. And you look at that, you look at Saddam Hussein, and you can see these huge disparities. And you say, you know, this guy knew what he was doing, this guy didn't. And it's the same thing with the Star Wars movies. Where it's done right, then it feels very believable. And you say, you know, this is what it must be like to be in combat or be in the military. When it's not done right, it's just laughable. And you think, gee, you know, it's turned into a cartoon. When I think of these kinds of things, I think of the Lord of the Rings movies that Peter Jackson did, because there was one scene where they actually, in the Two Towers, the second book, they assaulted Theoden's fortress. And so Theoden, of course, was on the defense, and the orcs and Saruman's forces were on the offense. And the advantage always goes to the army that's on the offense, because they're the ones that have a plan that they had thought out. And it's the defenders that don't know what the opposition's going to do. And so they're going to have to react to everything, whereas the other team has a playlist. And that's usually why offensive operations are much more effective than any kind of defensive operation. It's because it's like football. You're trying to get the football down to the other end of the field and into the end zone. And I thought that particular battle scene from start to finish showed a perfect example of how you would conduct an offensive operation. and do it under very difficult circumstances and prevail. And in this case, it happened to be the bad guys that were prevailing, and it was only because of, you know, a miracle, literally, that they were saved at the last minute.
Mm-hmm. Well, this book dives very, very deep into a lot of the, like, all the moving parts that go together to form a fighting force. You have part one is about the personnel, the people. Part two is about the weapons. Part three is about the technology. Part four, tactics and strategy, which I am going to dive into a little bit. And part five, which is lessons learned from key battles, which you have picked big battles from all across the movies that have come out so far. But to me, the most fascinating part is your breakdown of the people doing the fighting. You talk about good leadership, bad uniforms.
Yes.
And
stormtroopers uniforms.
And just the danger of overconfidence. That's really something I want to dig into. But break down for our listeners how you view the personnel comparisons between the Rebel Alliance and the Empire.
Well, we don't really know exactly what they call the TONE, the Table of Organization and Equipment, is for the Rebels, because, you know, Rebels tend to be more of a ragtag force where they're scavengers and they've got to acquire whatever weapons and assets as best they can, and they're just not going to have the endless supply that, say, the Galactic Empire is going to have. So they're going to have to, basically, it's a guerrilla force, which means they have to work harder, smarter, and faster, because the enemy is much greater, has better weapons, and has more resources. And so this is where it really where personnel makes a big, big difference. And a good example of that is during the Vietnam War. You know, when we were up against the North Vietnamese Army, we went in with this notion that we could just go in and just bomb them into oblivion. And we had, you know, Huey helicopters and air assault teams, and, you know, we could just bomb them and then we could just strafe them, and the next thing you know, the war would be over. And, of course, look what happened. I mean, we wound up, I guess you could call it a stalemate if you want, but most military leaders would say, well, it was a defeat for the United States because we didn't accomplish the mission. The mission was to stop communist aggression across that part of Asia, and we simply didn't do it. In the end, we simply walked away, and then the North Vietnamese overran South Vietnam, and it became a communist country, which it is still now. But look at what the North Koreans had to deal with and fight with. They had just nothing. But what they had was they had a great knowledge of their terrain and natural terrain, and they were able to dig tunnels and move equipment and men. They were able to have entire hospitals and offices and complexes and headquarters all buried under the ground so that the bombers could drop all the bombs they wanted and it would make no effect. And they learned that lesson from what happened in World War II when we were up against the Japanese in Iwo Jima, where General, I think it was Hayabashi, had put everything underground and had done it so well that even after Iwo Jima was bombarded, the Japanese soldiers actually survived and they were able to hold out and fight a very vicious and long battle that we won only because we had so much firepower. And, you know, at some point the Japanese simply ran out of ammunition and ran out of men. So, you know, this whole notion that might equals right just doesn't work on the battlefield, because it all really does come down to leadership. A smaller force with better leadership has a fighting chance against a larger force with overconfident leaders. And that's what you have in the Galactic Empire. You know, I think it's you start with Darth Vader, who had, as far as I can see, no military training. You've had his bosses, which again had no military training. The problem there is that they're trying to make military decisions that are going to affect key battles and whatnot, and they just didn't know how to make them. And instead of letting the military people do what they're good at, you have, you know, Darth Vader walking around killing people because he gets angry at them and force choking them, and you know it's not good for morale to begin with, and you don't respect the guy for doing that. You think, you know, the guy's just a bully. You know, to hell with the force if this is what they do. And you know, the big flaw with Star Wars is the fact that when you knock out those you know, you knock out the leaders, then the whole everything just tended to fall apart. Whereas the Rebel Alliance was very cohesive. They too had a chain of command, and they too had a lot of people, but these are people that were more experienced in military operations. These weren't, you know, even General Kenobi, Ben Kenobi. I mean, he fought in the Clone Wars. So a lot has to be said for the senior leadership. And if you have good senior leadership, then you'll probably go fairly far and be able to accomplish the mission. But if you don't have that kind of leadership, you're going to have people like Darth Vader, who runs around inspiring, not inspiring the men, but having a culture of fear, which is really very counterproductive in the military.
Yeah, I could see where people under Darth Vader's command would tend to not want to bring him bad news.
Well, not only that, but see, in an environment like that, then what happens is you have a culture of lies. And so you would start, and you see that now actually with the White House, where you know, Donald Trump doesn't react well to good news, and so they say all sorts of things, and they tend to repeat what he wants to hear. You know, he wants to hear that he's doing a great job, and so that's what his subordinates tell him. But you know, it'll be interesting to see how things work out for the remaining 2.5 years left.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, if you have a leader who's very, very confident in himself, then he doesn't need to have the praise of his subordinates. He doesn't seek it. He doesn't want it. You know, when you look at great generals like Schwarzkopf, you know, he was a man who everybody, you know, there was a reason they called him Stormin Norman, because if he got mad, you really wanted to get out of the way. You know, he was a big man. You know, he passed away a few years ago, but I mean, this guy was a bear of a man, and that was one of his nicknames. He was called the Bear. He was gruff. Sometimes he was, you know, he would blow up and get angry. But all of that aside, he was also a very well-trained military officer who had been doing this for, you know, over 30 years, and it makes a big, big difference.
Now, you have a section in here talking about, who was it, Admiral Ozzel and his replacement, Admiral Piette. Do you think that Piette maybe should not have been the one to get the promotion? Because you talk about his performance later in Return of the Jedi and how poor it was.
Well, there's a couple things that you're dealing with here. The first thing is that we really don't know what the chain of command is with the Galactic Empire. And if Piette was a senior naval officer there in the area, and the protocol states that he would be the next one in line if Ozzel dies, then that is pretty much a matter of course.
And that's confuses me.
That's a promotion based on the chain of what we call the chain of command. Now, as it turned out, in battle, he did make some tactical mistakes, and these are the mistakes that started compounding very rapidly because the battle was occurring very quickly in space, and it led to the destruction of that massive super star destroyer. And so, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that when you have someone like Piette, who, if he's an admiral, that would mean that he would probably have, you know, give or take maybe 20 years of experience in the military. This experience is hard to replace because it takes a lot of time. Reconstructing a military force from scratch it takes probably 20 to 30 years, ideally, because you've got to replace, in the case of all the people lost on the Death Star, you've got to replace everybody from the mechanics to the pilots and to the command leadership. And it's not a matter of just snapping your fingers and saying, okay, you do this, you do that. You know, these jobs are very, very specific in their duties, and it takes a lot of time to train these people to do things right. So in Piet's case, you know, if I had been Darth Vader, if I didn't have a choice, I would say, okay, you're now the acting admiral. And then I would take a little time and figure out who I would really want to replace Ozzel with. And as a good leader, you would probably have a pretty good idea anyway of who you would want to promote. So you wouldn't be guessing in the dark or making a snap judgment. You pretty much know who you're going to pick anyway. And then you take someone like Piet, if you think, well, the guy's not really working out, he's not quite ready for this, then you assign him to some other job where he can spend more time and learn a little bit more about his profession. But the nature of the military is that in stress situations and certainly in combat, you sometimes don't have the luxury of being able to pick and choose whomever you want. You've got to pick the next man in line and hope he can do the job.
And that was the thing that bugged me when I first started thinking about the hierarchy of the fleets and the ships, because if Piet was second in command of Ozzel's fleet, he probably wouldn't have been on the same ship, because if the ship gets destroyed, they're both gone. would have been on a different ship.
This is what we call the dispersal of forces. And so, you know, you do have to plan for casualties. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. You just don't. For instance, in the U.S. Navy, you know, you're going to have the fleet commander, and he's going to be on a ship that's basically unprotected, mostly. I mean, he's got all the firepower all around him. So you know, all the other ships can defend him. The nature of combat is fast moving and fluid, and so you would normally disperse your key personnel as well. You'd still have your command staff right there, but you would probably in combat have Piet would technically be probably a rear admiral as opposed to a full admiral. So I think a rear admiral, I'd have to look it up. I think he's equivalent like to a one-star general, you know, and depending on a fleet commander, he might be a two-star. Just depends on how the Star Wars universe is configured. But, you know, you would have, ideally, your key personnel in a combat situation dispersed precisely for that reason.
Yeah, so that's just one of those things that when you don't think about it when you're watching the movie, but 2 weeks later when you're having a beer, you're going, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, and that happens all the time. You watch a movie and it's so fast paced, you get caught up in the story. And then by the time you get home or, you know, you go out and have dinner after, where you sit there and you start thinking about the movie and say, well, gee, there's a few plot holes here that you could fly a starship through, you know?
Yeah. So the other sections you go into is the overconfidence, and oh yeah, you have a chapter on Jar Jar, which is I can't deal. Mm-hmm. But talk the overconfidence.
He's gonna understand.
The overconfidence thing seems to be a recurring motif in the Star Wars universe. You'd think they would just get over that, maybe.
Well, you know, part of it is that when you have this massive firepower, you know, the number one rule, Sun Tzu is a famous Chinese military tactician, he points out that two of the most important things you have to know is you have to know yourself and you have to know the enemy. And those are two of the tenets that the U.S. Army believes in very strongly as well. And part of it is that you have to be able to assess your own strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, the problem with having enormous firepower at your fingertips is that you think going into a battle that you're going to have necessarily the upper hand. And that's usually true, but not always true. And the problem with that is that right now in the real world, you've got China building up its military. Russia is pretty much doing whatever it wants in Europe without NATO putting up much of a defense, including us being there. And, you know, you have a situation where, unlike the past, we're approaching what we call in the military parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y, which means that their forces are equivalent to ours in terms of their strengths. And in some cases, they actually exceed ours because they're putting an enormous amount of money into new technologies. You know, the new Chinese fighter jets have stealth capability like we have, and it took us a decade or two to acquire that kind of technology. The Chinese are improving their missiles so that they're able to have missiles that are going to be able to take out aircraft carriers, you know, flying literally just above the level of the sea level, right above the waterline, traveling at an incredible speeds to take out aircraft carriers. And an aircraft carrier is a $1 billion piece of equipment, $1 billion, and we only have, I think, 10 to 13 in the U.S., and we have the best in the world, but, you know, these can be, I think these are very vulnerable targets now. And so now you have a situation where, you know, the thought of the U.S. fighting the Chinese or the thought of the U.S. fighting the Russians isn't really a picnic anymore. We just can't go in and say, well, we've got more this and more that, and, you know, the Chinese have got more men. They can fight an extended land battle, and they've got the manpower. They vastly outnumber us. So, you know, overconfidence is a big issue because, again, it all gets back to leadership, and it all gets back to personnel, and it all gets back to the man on the battlefield. And, you know, that's why the training is so important in the military training. You just get the sense when you look at Star Wars that the military is not trained as well as it should have been, especially in terms of marksmanship. They need to spend a lot of time with small arms firing and set up training stations and get them to improve their firing because they shoot blindly. So.
And my friends will be proud of me that I did not break out a line from The Princess Bride when you started talking about fighting in China and Russia. Go into more about the arms, the small arms, because the starting joke at the beginning when Star Wars first came out was stormtroopers couldn't hit the broadside of a barn if they tried. But mm-hmm. We've seen that they can be fairly accurate, deadly accurate when they have to be. And the different I think Rogue One was the first time we saw the ground troops mm-hmm. with different types of weapons. But the weapons that each side has, where are the rebels getting their supplies? Are they just picking up stuff from stormtroopers that have fallen? Or
well,
do they have their
usually
own?
Yeah, usually rebels are going to get their supplies by any means they can, and a lot of it is either going to be black. A lot of it's black market. Mm-hmm. I mean, traditionally guerrillas yeah. use, you know, it's black market stuff, or it's captured enemy munitions. I mean, during the Iraq, I mean after Iraq, you know, we were fighting the Taliban, but we're really fighting ISIS, which was created in the power vacuum that we actually created. We had a big hand in all of that, in the creation of ISIS indirectly. And what ISIS did is they went in places where the Iraqi army that we tried to reconstitute, we gave them, you know, our weapons, and we gave them Humvees and brand-new tanks and all this. And there was several battles where they just simply got up and ran, and they just abandoned entire bases filled with munitions, ammunition, guns, machine guns, all of that. And the ISIS people just came in and picked them up and used them against us. So that's one way rebels acquire weapons. you know, certainly in the Star Wars universe, we know there's a lot of smuggling because that's what Han Solo was. He was really an intergalactic smuggler. So the black market plays a big part of it. There may be some legitimate things where they're able to make deals and get surplus equipment at a discounted price or in trade for promises that will be rendered in the future, that kind of thing. A lot of it, you know, they're going to be short on money, but they really rely a lot on goodwill and saying, you know, well, right now we don't have the money, but, you know, we're going to have it in the future because we're going to be doing this and that and this and that, and we're going to capture this and that, and then, you know, people might believe it.
Now, what about the comparable fighters that both sides have? You got the TIE fighters, you've got the X-Wings, the Y-Wings. I'm a big fan of the X-Wing, actually. The fighting techniques that we've seen in the space battles between the fighters, how realistic, how accurate are those compared to, you know, the dogfights of World War II or Vietnam, say?
Well, there's the major difference is that you're dealing and you're fighting in an entirely different environment, which is outer space. And, you know, when you're fighting, you know, what happened is that, you know, with the U.S. military after Vietnam, after the Vietnam War, dogfighting became a lost skill because we simply weren't engaging the enemy in dogfights. And it reminds me of what General Chuck Yeager, the guy that broke the sound barrier first, said about pilots. And he said, you know, the only difference between pilots all over the world, and he said, I've flown with everybody, is the amount of time they've had in the cockpit. It's all about experience, which is also why during World War II, the Japanese had a really tough time because they were losing pilots at such a high rate because of the kamikaze program, that they were putting pilots up in the skies that were just really young boys right out of, they were actually usually liberal arts majors that were considered expendable, whereas the young men who were in hard sciences were considered essential. And they had minimum training, and they went up, and the American aces were able to shoot them down because the Americans simply had better pilots that had spent more time in the air and had more experience. So, you know, that speaks to why the training is so important, because even though the Galactic Empire has pretty decent bombers, fighters, and what have you, you know, the rebel forces with their X-Wing fighters turned out to be a pretty formidable force. Now, you have to remember, in the first movie, there was the rebels had dispatched roughly about 30 aircraft, bombers and fighters. And out of that, even though the Galactic Empire really basically responded to the attack, which speaks of what we talked about earlier about the two towers, where if you're on the offensive, you've got the advantage. The rebels had the advantage because they were on the attack. But even with that, because of the assets and the numbers of ships that the Galactic Empire has, they were able to take out all but three vehicles, all but three ships that the rebels had by the end of the movie. And that was when they were caught off guard. If they had known in advance that this attack was coming, they would have taken out all of them. So the Death Star, the first Death Star, you know, if they had had an appropriate defensive battle plan, the Death Star, the first Death Star would still be here.
So do you think the space battle, even between the larger ships, the capital ships, and the fighters, do you think that was realistic enough to satisfy?
Well, you know, these large ships are like aircraft carriers. These are enormously expensive ships to buy, to build, to man. And it just seems to me like, in the movies, these ships are treated a little more cavalierly than they should be, by which I mean you shouldn't have these things fly so close together that they're going to start bumping into each other. There's just no reason for that. You know, you don't see aircraft carriers that close, and for a reason. You don't want to lose the aircraft carrier. And I haven't seen the new Star Wars movie, Solo, but I saw a trailer and it looked like there were a couple of Star Destroyers that were so close that the Millennium Falcon had to weave in and out in order to avoid getting scraped by either one of them. And, you know, the U.S. Air Force has a plan called the deconfliction plan, and it accounts for how they marshal and basically act as air control during a combat operation for friendly fighters. Because what you don't want is when you have this limited airspace that you're using, people just can't fly wherever they want. They just can't do that because there's other things that are going to be happening. You know, for instance, in the real world, when you have a land combat, you're going to have artillery weapons and rocket systems firing at the same time at the same enemy as you have planes in the sky. And so you have to assign air corridors so that the Air Force will be in a path so that they're not going to be accidentally blown out of the sky by an artillery round. You have to basically orchestrate the battle. And you of course can't orchestrate what the enemy's going to do, but you can orchestrate what you're going to do. And this is why, you know, when you saw in the first movie the scene on the moon, the rebel moon, where you've got these large charts and they're mapping positions and whatnot. You know, nowadays you do all that electronically, and it's all handled by AWACS up in the sky with these big domes on top of Boeing aircraft that will track, you know, inbound, outbound, enemy and friendly aircraft. They're there simply to be the band leader and orchestrate the air assets. And that's what we saw in the first Star Wars movie as well.
Hmm. What about the Death Star as either a deterrent or a first strike weapon? What, in your opinion, from a military standpoint, should they have made that? Should they have made it that big?
Well, my thinking is always, you know, when you make a terror weapon, it's such a high value target that it's like a magnet. It's going to draw the enemy to you. And you know, if for instance the Japanese had known that we were developing an atomic bomb that we were going to drop on them, they would have done everything they could to get into the U.S. and take out the Los Alamos and all the research facilities to prevent the construction of the bomb itself. But you know, the bomb caught them completely by surprise. It absolutely did, because the Japanese were more concerned at the time about the firebombings, and that was creating a big toll. With a weapon like the Death Star, the big problem again is what we talked about earlier about the allocation of personnel, where you don't have all your officers or staff in one place. You know, if you wanted to have the same kind of, you know, because it's actually, the Death Star is actually a psychological weapon mostly, you know, because the theory is, well, we've got this thing and we're going to demonstrate it, and once everybody sees what it can do, then they're going to just bow down and do whatever we want them to do. And the better way to have done it would have been to have, say, a half a dozen Death Stars, smaller, and have them adequately protected as they went through the universe. And if you had to, you could have two or three of the Death Stars circling an enemy planet and consolidating their power and firing at the same time. I mean, you would probably have about the same destructive effect. You know, it's like in the field artillery, it's what we call the massing of fires. So instead of having simply one artillery gun firing and going out to hit a target, you can actually orchestrate so that you've got the entire division artillery, which would be dozens of artillery guns firing at the same instant with the time of flight calculated, so that all the rounds impact at the same place at the same time. And so it's much more, the effect is much more powerful. And so with a Death Star, instead of having simply one roaming the galaxy, you could have had a half a dozen, And that would have been not only more effective militarily, because then the rebel forces would have to deal with six different Death Stars at some point, but these Death Stars could move in tandem, they could move in pairs, and because they require less personnel to fly it and maintain it and support it, then if you lose a Death Star, it's not the end of the world. But in the first Star Wars movie, when you lose a Death Star, it set everything back, because you're dealing with a weapon system that had, I think, what, over a million men inside? I mean, it had a massive force inside, and it dealt a crippling blow to the Galactic Empire.
Because most of the top echelon of military leadership were also on that ship.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you had the whole, you had the command staff there, and then you had trained fighter pilots, which takes, you know, years to train a pilot. Plus, you've had all the mechanics, and you had the weapons system officers. You know, the wealth of talent that was destroyed in that one blast is incalculable. And so to reconstitute a comparable force to that would probably take a minimum of 20 years, but more likely 30 if you were to completely replace it. And that's the problem that you have when you consolidate everybody in one location, because that's where the enemy is going to go, and that's where the enemy is going to attack, because it's the grand prize.
I guess that speaks to how huge the empire was, because they had so many more, I guess, conscripts to pull from.
Yes, and so, you know, that is, I think that's certainly implied, because when they had, you know, the other thing too in the real world is that George Lucas didn't have any real hope that there would be a second movie, because, you know, it would depend entirely on how well the first movie did. So, you know, he perhaps had a rough idea of what he wanted to do, you know, if he were to extend the series. But, you know, when you get to the point where you have a second Death Star, and the only difference is it's bigger and more powerful, then you're really setting yourself up for the same problems, but on just a slightly larger scale. And then, of course, you have the same situation the third time with the standalone movie. And so you have a planet destroyer and capable of taking out entire systems one after the other, you know, boom, 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 like a shooting gallery. And of course, you know, the rebel fighters had to come in and take them out. So it's three times. They've made the same mistake three times. There you go. They made the same mistake three times, and they didn't learn from their mistakes. So after the first Death Star, they should have said, well, you know, we constructed this wonderful death weapon, and you could see the overconfidence, because you had one of the admirals or generals sitting in that dark room, and Darth Vader was in there, and he was saying, Darth Vader was saying, well, don't be so overconfident with this Death Star that you've created, or whatever he said. You know, he was basically speaking to the overconfidence of the command staff there, that thought, well, you know, we've got this wonderful death weapon that can roam the galaxy, and all we have to do is point it at a planet, and they're gonna capitulate. Well, you know, that's a good example of why you disperse your forces. When you concentrate them all in one place, that's where the enemy's going to come.
The strategies employed by the rebels in Rogue One to actually steal the plans for that first Death Star and get them back to the rebel fleet, that's actually one of your battle analysis chapters, the skirmish on Jedha.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna back up here a little bit, because when you have space battles, you have ground forces too. The ground forces are on the planet. If you have a weapon that can blow up the planet, why would you send your ground forces onto the planet? I don't get it. I really don't. I've never, every space opera battle scene, you always have, you know, one ship dropping down with the ground forces and then getting out of the way, but you have battles going on, and they can actually do planetary bombardments or blow up the planet. I'm like, what am I missing?
It reminds me of the start of the Iraq War when Baghdad was being bombed, and they had footage, and you could see all this anti-aircraft fire go and tracers go up in the skies, and it just looked like this mess of steel heading skyward to take out the planes, because these were stealth fighters that came in. First you send in the radar jammers and take up, and you jam the radar so you deny them the air defense artillery assets, and then you bring in the fighters and you take out the radar installations, and then and take out whatever planes you can and whatnot. And so the Air Force general finally stands up and he says, well, this is bombing campaign of Baghdad was a campaign of shock and awe. And he was just so proud of the fact that the Air Force had basically done this wonderful job of bombing without any casualties. And the thing is that that's the easy part in terms of a battle. The hard part is that if you're going to do anything on the ground, the dynamic changes completely. You're dealing with now boots on the ground in an enemy territory where they have the advantage of knowing the terrain, the weather, the people, everything. Now you're in hostile territory. And so in a normal situation, if you can get away with a battle where you can take them out by air without the necessity of even going to the ground, you would do that. You would do that because it's more efficient, it's faster, and it puts fewer troops in harm. And it's like with the Star Wars, and they were aware of this actually in the Star Wars movie where they had the attack on the Battle of Hoth, because then they said, well, they've set up this planetary shield and our bombers we're not going to be able to bomb them from here. We're going to have to send in, ground troops and do a ground assault. And that was fine as far as that went. But mm-hmm. The problem was that the Galactic Empire, obviously used transport aircraft to get those troops down to the ground and to get those giant AT-ATs to the ground. So they obviously had the ability to use planes to get to the planet. Right? And so if they had air assets that they could actually deploy on the surface of the planet, they may as well have deployed some aircraft for close air support, meaning high-powered jet aircraft or the equivalent that were able to strafe and bomb to support the AT-ATs that were lumbering across the snowfield.
Yeah. Now
and they didn't do that. They didn't do that at all, but the rebels had snow speeders that were able to fly, and then they were able to fly X-wing fighters and get them off the planet. And so that was a major, major tactical blunder in my view. You would not send down ground troops without air cover. You just aren't going to do that mm-hmm. because you've got those assets, and that's exactly what they're designed for. When you have any major ground operation, it's as in Desert Storm, you had F-16 fighter jets for close air support, and you had A-10, what we call warthogs, that fire depleted uranium shells, which can punch through a tank. And that way the troops, especially when they're dismounted, have protection. And I think on the Battle of Hoth, I'm pretty sure I saw dismounted troops in snow gear, mm-hmm. Stormtroopers out there running around. And if that's the case, I'm sure they were sitting there saying, well, why couldn't the blankety-blank people in headquarters give us some air support? Because the grunt on the field, the infantryman, always wants something to back him up.
Yeah, the Hoth battle, that made sense because they actually specifically said we can't do anything from orbit because of the planetary, the shield they have around whole planet, but around their base. They were protected with that. But I think in Endor, it was the other way around. They couldn't, there was an air battle going on above them, and along with the ground battle. And it just, I don't know, there have been some instances where I've said, why would you send troops on the ground to fight? Because you're fighting in the space around the planet. And that just happens when I'm thinking too much about it, because I'm looking for something to argue about.
The moon of Endor, that's the one with the Ewoks?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the shield, the garrison that was located on that moon of Endor projected a beam that protected the Death Star. Correct?
Correct.
So what you have here is what we call a synchronized operation. And the reason it had to be synchronized is that in order for the air fleet to attack and take out the Death Star, they couldn't get past the shield that protected the Death Star until the shield was disabled. That's why they needed the ground troops. That's why they needed Han Solo to deactivate that shield by going to the garrison and getting control of it and or destroying the garrison so that the force field would dissipate, then allowing the Air Force to attack the Battle Star. Death Star.
Same thing. Battle Star, Death Star. No.
Right.
No, so, I would get in trouble.
That's what you have there is they did complicate it a bit by making the mission more difficult. But the same military principles still apply. You have a weapon that is the same thing as a previous weapon. It's just bigger and better and badder. And so, of course, the Rebel Alliance is going to have to attack that as well.
Cool. So what other parts of battle tactics and strategies stood out to you in any of the movies as being particularly well done?
Well, gosh, that's a good question. I really tended more to look toward things that were teaching points where things went wrong, because you can learn a lot more from what goes wrong than what you can from when things go right. I'd almost have to sit down and skim the movies again just to refresh my memory on some of these major battles. But they all seem, actually, in retrospect, to be very coincidental. You know, when, for instance, in the battle where you have the Gungans up against the drones that have come down on these massive transport ships, they prevailed, but only because of basically something they didn't expect. And coincidence is always going to be part of life and part of battle, but it has to be believable. And in many, many cases, you know, I think the Galactic Empire, with the right training, the right leadership, and the right military doctrines, should have been able to prevail in every single instance, because they simply had the assets on hand, and the rebel forces were never, in terms of sheer numbers, that formidable. You know, the best they could come up with in the first movie was 30 ships, which included bombers and fighters. And if that wasn't enough to save the day, then that meant that the moon that they were temporarily having a base on for operations would have been destroyed, and it would have also meant the first Death Star would be roaming the galaxy and firing at will and taking out planets whenever they wanted. But, you know, you wouldn't have much of a movie if the bad guys won all the time. But, you know, it makes me think of Game of Thrones, because, again, I haven't seen the movies and I haven't read the books yet. I'm still waiting to do that. The thing that made George Martin's, or one of the things that made George Martin's series so interesting, is that he felt that nobody is exempt. And so, you know, when you see Star Wars and you say, well, you know, Mark Hamill was going to survive this and he's going to survive that, And, you know he's going to be in the next movie and then in the next movie and whatnot. Then you feel like it's a little unreal because you don't get the sense of dread that this person could die at any time. Whereas in George Martin's universe, people die all the time, and it's not the people you necessarily expect.
Yep.
And that's more truth, and that's more realistic, and that's much more truthful to what happens in combat, whether it's in Westeros, which is a medieval kind of environment, or in Star Wars, which is a futuristic environment.
Yep.
I mean, it's much like, actually, it also recalls Avatar, where you've got, you know, this ground assault, well, you know, an air assault mostly, and a ground assault, I guess, against these arboreal aborigines who fly these colorful dragons. And, you know, there's just no compelling reason to think that the indigenous population who have the technology of the Ewoks are going to prevail. It just doesn't make any sense. And I think it's just been a while since I've seen Avatar, but I think, you know, I think I can't remember how they prevailed, but I do believe they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you know, it just doesn't ring true to me.
Well, James Cameron is moving ahead with a sequel, so.
I know. But, you know, it's interesting because they had one scene, and it was a big scene where the Avatar was fighting off and fighting the guy who was in this military walker, this vehicle that was kind of humanoid shaped and had a bubble, and he was self-contained and all that, and he was able to fight in this basically big robot. And I think what we're going to see in the military, the real world military, is much more of a shift toward mechanized capabilities, you know, mechanized infantry, real mechanized infantry, as opposed to what we call mechanized infantry now. And you're going to have more drones, and you're going to have self-piloting or drone boats and torpedoes and all this kind of thing. I mean, technology is going to be really the big issue of the next war, and I think, you know, if we ever have World War III, it's going to be relying a lot on technology, which is why, for instance, you know, we're now thinking of a space command, because the military has realized, U.S. military has realized that the fighting force that has control of the skies has control of the ground. Because if you take out the satellites, then they're going to lose communications.
Mm-hmm.
Once you lose your command and control, things become very chaotic very quickly. And so basically we're looking at space marines now and a space navy and, a, you know, what have you. And the military is trying to figure out, you know, how are you going to comprise and add, you know, a space command, because the Air Force wants control of that, whereas Trump feels that should be a different, separate branch of the military. But we're going to see space commandos, believe it. We're going to see them. And, you know, the next battle is going to start in space, and it's going to take out, once the communication satellites are down, then it's going to be a whole different kind of war on the ground. There's going to be more drones and more airborne drones, and there's going to be little tiny drones for reconnaissance and movement of small troops. There's going to be troops on the ground with smart helmets that's going to let them see what's going on the battlefield, and then you're going to have basically a mechanized soldier, you know, that's entirely mechanical, and they're the ones that are going to go first, and because they're going to be expendable, you know, and they're going to have limited AI. So, you know, the World War III, if and when it comes, is going to be much, much different from, say, World War II. It's going to be a faster, more complex, more technologically savvy war than what we've had in the past. And this is where science fiction writers, I think, can do a real service, you know, because a lot of them are imagining different kinds of equipment and different kinds of scenarios. And basically, I think the future has arrived. Science fiction has arrived, you know,
yeah.
It's Starship Troopers time.
Yeah, there was a movie in the 80s called Robot Jocks that each...
I've never heard it. Never heard.
It's Robot Jocks, spelled, I think, J-O-X. And each country had a champion giant robot that was piloted by a soldier for them. So whenever there was a conflict, the robots would fight each other. And they took that concept farther with Pacific Rim, which was just a glorious movie. But and then you have, in real life, Japan challenged the United States recently to a giant robot battle. And they have their own giant robot ready. And the U.S. is building theirs, I believe. And I, for one, am curious to see how it turns out. Because we're going to have giant robot battles, really, for real.
Wow. Boy, you know, whenever you think that fiction is strange, you find out that truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, the real world got nothing on fiction.
Now the other thing, of course, that is really a big development in the military, in our military, is the inclusion of women as they integrate into the military in virtually every possible job.
Yeah.
Where for many, many, many years, in fact, for the history of a lot of these services, these women were simply excluded.
I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out, because I've seen how defensive and protective some geeks get when a girl walks into a comic book store, and I'm like, really? It's a comic book. Just chill.
Right.
It's probably amplified.
The dynamic is certainly there, not to mention the shock value. You know, I mean, I remember the first time I went out to the field, I was in an artillery unit, and I went out to take a leak, and as I, you know, went into the woods a little bit, I heard someone screaming at me, and it was a woman who was using her entrenching tool to dig a cat hole so she could move her bowels, and I had no idea there were any women anywhere. You know, I just kind of surprised her by walking up close enough so she could recognize me, and you know, we weren't told that there were any women out there, and so we thought it was all males, you know, and so you do behave differently. You don't sit and look twice, but you also don't want to walk into a situation where, you know, someone else is doing their private business and you're kind of interrupting it. If there's all males, that's not an issue. But when you have women in the area, that is an issue. So it's a big change, you know, it's a big social change for the military.
Do you think they'll ever get it figured out?
Well, you know, I don't think that when it comes to men and women, I don't think it's ever been, the social dynamics, I don't think has ever been figured out in any environment, you know. I just think that men and women are sufficiently different where there's just going to be some natural friction. You see that at work. You see that in the military. The military is simply a reflection of the civilian society, because that's where it draws on its personnel. You know, I just think that this is why when Ursula Le Guin wrote a novel called The Left Hand of Darkness and postulated a culture where it was the culture was unisex, that changed the dynamic of everything. People are going to behave differently.
Yeah, it's a fabulous book.
So we're gonna see. In fact, there's a wonderful biography that's coming out, a movie, a documentary that was kickstarted, and that's actually going to be screening in this summer or this fall. And it is done because they're showing it in Portland. As a memorial for her. But, you know, when it comes to men and women, I just think there's going to be always a culture clash, and that's been true throughout really all of history. And it's just, you know, some of the changes are so monumental that it's hard, especially for an old, entrenched military culture, for people in the military to accept it. You know, when you have women, for instance, going through ranger training, which was something that was only there for men, or you have women that now are capable of being SEALs if they can pass the very rigorous training that they have, you know, it changes things. On the other hand, when you look at the Israeli army and look at the number of women who are in the Israeli army, and most of them are reservists, these women are young and deadly, and you know, they don't have to apologize for being female. They're just as deadly as the men. It has to do with weapons training and hand-to-hand combat and all of these other things.
So the possibility of learning to adjust does exist. Good.
It's got to happen. I mean, yeah. Because the military is changing in that direction. It's the way of the future, they're going to have to embrace it whether they like it or not. And I think eventually, in time, I think things will become more assimilated. And that's, again, a reflection of how, you know, science fiction writers have foreseen this. Joe Haldeman writes about that wonderfully in The Forever War, where the troops are male and female and perfectly integrated. And, you know, it's the sense of shared mission that makes them all want to work together toward a common goal. And it doesn't matter whether, in his book, whether you're male or female. You know, you're still a grunt, an infantry person. So I think there's hope.
Excellent. There, we have hope. Excellent, excellent. So what are you currently working on? What's your next pop culture adventure?
Well, I think I'm going to take something of a break from pop culture. There's something that Stephen King said that I really believed in. And he said, after he's been working on things one after the other, one project after another, he said, well, I got to let the well fill back up. And I kind of feel like that right now. I kind of feel like I want to step away from the typewriter and the computer and start thinking of some options in terms of what I want to write next. And there's some nonfiction subjects that have nothing to do with pop culture that I would like to explore. And there's some ideas that I have in fiction that I would like to explore, because I think the time is right. I don't think that there's a whole lot more that I can write and contribute to in terms of pop culture, because I think that now the field is probably better suited for exploration by film. You know, I think we're really shifting toward large audiences where films are supplanting just everything. You know, you have all of these Marvel movies coming out from Disney, but the number of comic books that's being sold is really fairly low when you look at the numbers. And so it's not the source material that is really the prime impetus for people wanting to read comics, because that just doesn't exist in a universe where people go see a movie and there's millions of people. So, you know, just because somebody watches The Avengers on the big screen doesn't really mean or translate that they're going to go to a book equivalent. And we haven't, of course, seen that happen either. So, you know, I think now is a good time to sit and kind of think back and think about the next, you know, 5 years or 10 years or so, and think about what I really want to write, because all these books do take a long time. You know, any book that's 300 pages is going to take you about a year out of your life to write. And you want to sit down and say, gee, you know, a year is a good chunk of time, and you want to do something that you think is going to be fun and also something that's going to be profitable. And those projects are not necessarily that easy to come up with. You know, there's a lot of ideas out there, and getting a book published, even for someone that's done it as many times as I have, it's a challenge with every book.
Well, The Military Science of Star Wars is a fascinating deep dive for those who those Star Wars fans who really, really, really want to dig in. And to those people who were upset at the discussion many years ago we had that the Star Furies from Babylon 5 would beat the X-Wings from Star Wars, maybe this will help assuage some of your tendency to want to keep fighting that battle, because it ain't going to happen.
Yeah. I think it's very difficult to argue hypothetical against hypothetical.
We're geeks. Yeah. We can argue almost anything.
Well, and that's what geeks do. That is their meat and bread.
That is what we do so well. Well, George, thank you so much for your time and your insights today.
Well, this was fun.
The book is The Military Science of Star Wars, out now at your favorite retailers, both in print form and electronic form. Is there an audiobook?
And there is an audiobook, and I have to say that the reader is absolutely wonderful. He's a great voice actor, and he's done a wonderful job, and that's one way to enjoy the book.
Excellent. We will have links to all of that. Again, The Military Science of Star Wars, George Beam, thank you.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
And since we've gone really, really, really long with this interview, we're going to call it a show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to call in. The number is 602-635-6976. If you're having problems leaving messages on that number, give 602-456-9311 a try. We're going to try something different here. Indulge me. We're still working out some bugs because I said it before, I hate Microsoft. They've messed up Skype. I got to find something different. Anyway, you can also email me your questions or comments. The address to use there is summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio. If you're listening on iTunes or on Stitcher or both, please leave us a review there. Every review counts. Every rating counts. It lets people know that there are listeners enjoying the show and maybe they should check it out for themselves. Give us a listen, give us a review, and thank you very much for your patronage. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. You can follow us on YouTube or on Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi there. And of course, we have the website, sliceofscifi.com. I'd like to thank everybody for your donations and your pledges through Patreon. Every dime you pledge goes to support everything we do here, the shows, the websites, all of it. Your support is greatly appreciated. So thank you everyone who is currently pledging. If you want to help support the show, you can go to patreon.com/sliceofscifi, read some more there, and pick a level which to pledge. And again, thank you. Thank you so much. I want to send a special shout out to my favorite geek rock band, Sci-Fried, for providing the theme music for this show. They did a great job, and I'm a rock and roll girl and a geek girl, and everybody knows how much I love these guys, how much I love what they do. If you enjoy their music, go check their website out, sci-fried.com. They hit the road a couple times a year. See if they're coming to a sci-fi convention near you. And definitely, if you have the opportunity to see them play live, take advantage of it. That will do it for this episode. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me and with you. Take care.